I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate today, and this is WNYC and WNYC.org. Author David Haidu claims it wasn't Grand Theft Auto that started the generational culture wars. It wasn't rap, rock and roll, internet, or Elvis Presley either. Nope. Before all that, there was the comic book, which explored forbidden territory, inspired parental hysteria, and resulted in congressional hearings. Haidu says it was the comic that laid the foundation for the teen rebellion. His new book, The 10-Cent Plague, traces the history of this once humble art form. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm pleased it brings him here today. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Jonathan.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. It's good to be here.
Well, thanks for being here. Now, I understand you actually drew a comic strip in high school.
Oh, boy.
Called The Endless Odyssey of Skip Tumaloo.
I did.
Was that you?
I did. That made it. I don't think anyone else would have done anything so lame.
Yeah. Why was it lame?
These were the underground years, mm-hmm. and I was a high school student, and so I was trying to do an underground kind of thing, and it was about a slacker figure that was a projection of my self-image, and it wasn't really me, but it was this weirdly idealized idea of myself, which was kind of long-haired, hippie freak kind of guy. And I didn't know it at the time that my influences were the underground comics of the 70s. So mm-hmm. my influences were Crumb and the Fabulous Freak Brothers. But I had no idea that they had a set of influences going back to the 50s. Mm-hmm. the same way that as a rock fan, because I was a punk fan, I only had a tenuous notion of who the early rock and rollers were and how like Bo Diddley influenced the punks, mm-hmm. and no idea whatsoever of how the early blues people influenced the early rock and rollers.
Mm-hmm. So then, in terms of comic books, mm-hmm. Who invented the comics,
mm-hmm.
and where did they first appear?
Mm-hmm. The comic books first appeared in the 1930s, mid-1930s, and they were related to comic strips directly, mm-hmm. in that most of the first original comic book, the content of the first original comic books were rejected newspaper strips.
Mm-hmm.
So this was stuff that was considered not good enough to be published in newspaper strips. And there was a hierarchy at work in the way that comic strips and comic books were perceived. And comic strips in the 1930s had a kind of social cachet. They were considered, they had a kind of legitimacy already. And stuff that wasn't good enough to be published in comic strip was accepted in comic books. In fact, pretty much anything was accepted in comic books in the early years. It was absolutely wide open terrain.
Meaning that it could cover any, gore and sex, mm-hmm. and violence and that mm-hmm. sort of stuff?
Well, what I'm thinking of at the very early days of comic books was unconventional ideas. Like even the idea of Superman, which is a really kind of wild idea that was just considered like too kooky and not well enough drawn, not well enough rendered to appear in newspaper strips. Mm-hmm. It found a home in comic books. And there wasn't a lot of oversight. There weren't high standards and many rules in the comic book world. So as a result, it was wide open to a lot of people who couldn't get work in other places. Like even Siegel and Shuster, who created Superman, couldn't get work in the newspaper strips. And there were other people who wanted to work in professional illustration or in advertising or other modes of expression who didn't think that they would be accepted and probably wouldn't be accepted for reasons of either their ethnicity or their, mm-hmm. or their race or their sensibility, really, because they had kind of an outre sensibility. And they were welcome in comic books. And comic books were freewheeling, and they were wild, and they got wilder and wilder and wilder. And soon, and this is really what my book is about, they got darker and darker.
I was gonna ask, because you mentioned Superman, and most people, when they think of Superman, they have great feelings about Superman. And so then when you hear that there were wild congressional hearings on comic strips. Ladies Home Journal printed an article, A Crime Against American mm-hmm. Children. What? Mm-hmm. How did mm-hmm. we go from Superman to hysteria?
Almost? Well, the comic, yeah, there was a full-blown hysteria. Well, what happened was the comic books changed, and so did kids, and they seemed to be changing at the same time. No one quite knew why kids were changing, and comics became the scapegoat. And I think to some degree they weren't just a scapegoat. They were a cause. They were one of the reasons that young people changed. Well, what happened was the comic book readers aged. They grew into early adulthood and young adulthood. At the same time, the whole country kind of darkened during the war years. Because of the war, and home life was disrupted in the absence of fathers and the absence in the home of working mothers, and kids were freer and less beholden or held responsible to parents, and they were free to defy the rules, mm-hmm. And they increasingly did. So kids started becoming what when we think of young people today, we think of youth as a time when young people could defy their parents, defy the standards of society, even perhaps break the law, because that's what being an adolescent or being a young person is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a notion that wasn't as true prior to the war as it is today. During the war years, in the late 1940s, this state was pathologized as juvenile delinquency, and parents and authorities who were trying to come to terms with it and trying to come to terms with how young people seem to be changing glommed onto comic books as the reason.
Mm-hmm. David, let me ask you, because there was a hysteria about the content of the comic of comics, but let's talk about who was doing the comics.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of people who, in 1950s America, you wouldn't expect being doing something like this. These, if I remember correctly, these were people who were on the quote unquote periphery,
mm-hmm.
women, mm-hmm. African Americans, mm-hmm. mixed race people,
mm-hmm.
Jews. I mean, it was mm-hmm. very, mm-hmm. very creative community there.
I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of the content of comics in this point was an expression of outsider status, and even a pride in outsider status, and also an attempt to challenge the status quo or challenge authority by people who felt like outsiders of all sorts, and felt inhibited by the forces of authority at the time. So the great many Jewish Americans and Italian Americans, many more women than people realize. When I started my research, I was blithely unaware of the number of women who made comics in the early days. Asian Americans, African Americans, people who suffered kind of physical and psychological mm-hmm. handicaps or maladies, people who just couldn't function, some people who just couldn't function socially,
mm-hmm.
And even more than that, people who just had an outsider sensibility, either for reasons of the culture and because of reasons of race or ethnicity, or the culture they were raised, or just the way that they thought,
mm-hmm.
and they brought this sensibility to bear on the pages of comics. And comics, increasingly in the mid-1940s and into the late 1940s and 50s, were an outlet to challenge authority. So the original comics centered on crime fighting, but more and more comics centered on the doing of crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other kinds of coded challenges to authority and the horror And even romance comics.
Hold that thought, because I have to tell our guests. I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. This is the Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm sitting here talking with David Heydu, the author of The 10-Cent Plague. But it traces the history of the comic books. This is WNYC and WNYC.org, just in case you've forgotten. So you were saying that comic books, they dealt with crime and gore, but there was also romance.
Mm-hmm.
And while you said earlier there were lots of women involved in comic books, they weren't the ones who were doing the romance comic books, were they?
Well, there were a great many women in romance comics, but there were probably equal number or more men. I don't know the hard numbers, but women were doing all kinds of comics, and including romance comics. And a lot of romance comics were done by men. There was an important comics writer named Dana Dutch. Matt Baker, a brilliant African-American artist, was doing romance comics. Alvin C. Hollingsworth was also African-American. And Everett Kinsler, who became one of the leading portrait artists in America, and his work is in the National Gallery, did romance comics. And the interesting thing about romance comics, and the reason I devoted a full chapter and a lot of attention to them in the book, and the reason that they were part of the hysteria over comics, is that they were among the most overt challenges to the rules of proper society in the late 1940s and 1950s. And are the kind of a perceived conception of romance comics is mostly wrong. And it, you know, when we think of romance comics, we think maybe of Lichtenstein canvases, you know, of sad women kind of mourning the loss of their loves or some such.
Mm-hmm.
But romance comics encouraged a kind of sexual a freedom and independence on the part of young people that had very few parallels in any other form of expression at the time. I mean, there were story after story of young women defying their parents, defying their boyfriends, being the sexual aggressors, breaking the rules, going out for weekends with their boyfriends. There were stories like, this is a real title, I joined a teenage sex gang. Real time. Or my mother was my rival. You know?
Whoa, wait a minute. Yeah. Wait. You can't just throw out titles like that and then not give a little taste of this teenage sex gang thing. How graphic were these comics?
Well, they were lusty but not graphic, and how they challenged the codes of the society and how they were even subversive was more in their ideas than in what they depicted. I mean, graphically, girls. There were a lot of girls changing clothes, a lot of girls wrestling, discussing their problems with each other, and for some reason they always found the changing clothes the best time to discuss these issues. And it's one of the reasons I think that these comics were popular not only among girls but among boys.
Now David, though, but how is it possible that in an America where mom and dad slept in separate twin beds, separated by a nightstand, how do we go from that, the visual manifestation of American life, to I joined a teenage sex gang and talking about all sorts of intimate issues while changing my clothes?
Well, there was the FCC was regulating television and had a fairly stringent set of content regulations that Lucy and Desi had to adhere to, and radio programs had to adhere to, and film had the Hays Office that also had a fairly stringent set of content provisions. But there was nothing like that in comics at the time, and nobody was watching. So young people who felt like outsiders were making comic books. Nobody was paying that much attention for a long time until kids started to change. And then parents and PTAs and watchdog groups and religious organizations and soon the government started paying attention to the pages of comics. They said, oh my goodness.
And then those congressional hearings started.
Mm-hmm.
And so what was the spark that led to those hearings, and what happened?
Well, it was a smoldering, and they built up to a raging fire and a full blown hysteria, and this smoldering took many years to build, and it wasn't just that one day. You know, this is when I started working on the book. I was under the misconception that there was a little to-do over comics in the 50s, and it was probably part of the kind of overall paranoia of the time and probably an offshoot of McCarthyism. And, you know, some people raised some ruckus for a little while in the 50s. It wasn't the case at all. This started in 1940 with early criticisms of comics for being, you know, inducing illiteracy and being bad for the eyesight. And then the charges against comics built from the 40s to the 50s. And there was by 1948 already, there were nearly 50 pieces of legislation in cities around the country, either outlawing various kinds of comics or restricting the sale. And there were community boards set up and censors and screeners in cities who would weed good comics from the bad. And comics of various kinds, including crime comics, were flat out outlawed in the city of Los Angeles for a while.
Did that stand?
I mean, it stood for some time, and this was just the beginning. There was a comic dealer was arrested in the county of Los Angeles for selling a copy of Crime Does Not Pay. A newsstand dealer was arrested in the state of Maryland for selling comics. There were comic books were not various kinds were turned away at the newsstand and not sold, and they were burned. There were. Oblational bonfires and ritual burnings of comics from 1945 to just a few months after World War II for a period of 10 years, and dozens of them all around the country. I mean, there was a full-blown hysteria over this and over comic books and what they represented and what they seemed to be doing to young people.
Now, David, we have now less than a minute. After those hearings, a lot of people were then out of work. In the back of your book, you have a roster of people who, like the Hollywood blacklist. They never worked again.
Yeah, the appendix to the book I think of as kind of a war memorial, and it's a list of hundreds upon hundreds of names of people who were driven out of work, who lost their jobs and their livelihoods with the crackdown in comics. There's a parallel to the crackdown in Hollywood during the blacklist era, but affected a great many more people. And hundreds of people who loved comics, who felt like comics were the only place where they were welcome and could express the sensibility of theirs, and then they were driven out of work.
David, thank you. David Heydu, author of The 10-Cent Plague, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being here
today. Thanks, this was fun. Thanks for having me.